Welcome to Citizens Climate Radio. In this show, we highlight people's stories. We celebrate your successes, and together we share strategies for talking about climate change. I'm your host, Peterson Toscano. Welcome to episode 59 of Citizens Climate Radio, a project of Citizens Climate Education. This episode is airing on Friday, April 23rd, 2021. Today's show explores rebirth and birds, and even a little about travel. In the art house, you will hear about a man, a poet actually, who was going nowhere in life. His poetry was mediocre at best, and he was totally self-centered. Then he experienced a revelation. In fact, two. Two events changed his art, the way he looked at the world, and his relationship to the people around him. Though this happened over 100 years ago, his story provides insights into the kinds of breakthroughs people are experiencing today when it comes to climate change. You will also hear a good news report from Portland, Oregon. A group of high school students are changing public transportation policy. Even when they experience a temporary defeat, they relentlessly press on. But first, let's talk about the rough and tumble world of lobbying in the U.S. Capitol. Although, the way my guest talks about it, lobbying is literally a walk in the park.
My primary duty is a bird lobbyist, so to speak. I organize bird walks with members of Congress and congressional staff to demonstrate the conservation priorities of birds in ways that not only address climate change, but can also be economic stimulus, when also birding just gets people outside, and who doesn't like that over a meeting? You know, anybody can have a meeting where you talk about these numbers, you talk about the figures, which is important and still necessary. But it means something different when you can share an experience with these decision makers or the folks who inform the decision makers.
That's Tyke James. He is National Audubon Society's Government Affairs Coordinator. Tyke also co-organized last year's Black Birders Week.
I am left-handed. I think that's always important for people to know. I think it's also important to say that I am Black. I'm a Black birder.
Now, I confess, I used to think of birdwatching as an activity for retirees who have time and means to head to national parks. Frankly, it looked like a very peaceful, monotonous fringe hobby. Wow, was I wrong. I've gotten to know some serious birders back in the USA and now in South Africa where I live. With their binoculars, cameras, and mobile apps, they sit so still they make Quakers look restless. They watch and listen intently, and then experience moments of triumph. I now see that birding can be an action-packed competitive sport, and it's not just something to do in the rural countryside either.
Most of my birding overwhelmingly has been in cities, has been in the city of Philadelphia. There's birds here! David Lindo, shout out to David Lindo, he wrote the book on urban birding, literally and figuratively. Please check out David Lindo. I started my career in conservation. My start as a birder came as a job. Typically, it's a hobby for folks, but for me, it started as an environmental educator at the Cobbs Creek Community Environmental Education Center in West Philly, where my first assignment in a cohort of folks, our first assignment was a species to study. We study that species as much as we can. I got the belted kingfisher, so I was looking it up in the Petersons and the Audubon and the Sibleys. So I'm looking for, you know, everything I can get on it, try to present it, you know, when I come back to work. And when I came to work that next week, because it was a, you know, weekly weekend job, I got to see the belted kingfisher. I saw the female belted kingfisher on top of a cattail and do its call as it crossed the creek. Nothing gives me more joy than sharing that initial birding experience with someone who, like most people, see birding as a weird, why are you looking at things that are intentionally kind of hard to see? I can totally understand that. I like meeting people where they are in the middle of a conversation, stopping, looking up, and then like flexing my ears to see if I can pick up, was that a titmouse or a cardinal? And then they'll be like, what do you mean? Then we start talking about it.
Birding also made Tyche more acutely aware of social issues in his environment, issues that needed attention.
This job was connecting me to my community. It was connecting me to nature. It was connecting me to the history of injustice as to why, in my travels of watching birds in the city of Philadelphia, I see that some parks have park benches, street lights, and trash cans, more accessible, more maintained. And then other parks don't have those three elements, those fundamental building blocks of what makes a safe and welcoming park. When you ask yourself why and you look into the history of decisions that were made that made some people, some zip codes sacred, and some people and some other zip codes sacrificial, it becomes very clear that the determining factor is race and poverty, as to see where environmental blight, environmental hazards, and environmental burden are disproportionately placed. And I was able to see that just through bird watching.
In early spring last year, as the coronavirus pandemic was the number one global news story, another story also dominated the media.
The national conversation, when it was about the Black experience, it was particularly around the passing of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, and Ahmaud Arbery. Ahmaud Arbery, who was jogging in Georgia before he was taken from us. Sometimes I think that he could have been watching birds, right? Christian Cooper was doing his thing in Central Park, birding.
Sir, I'm asking you to stop.
A recorded confrontation in Central Park, which took a racially charged turn.
Can I take any pictures calling the cops?
Please call the cops. Please call the cops.
I'm going to tell them there's an African-American man threatening my life.
The man behind the camera, Chris Cooper, says this all started Monday morning. The avid birder was in the area of the park known as the Ramble.
The birds stop here and they are looking for habitat, and one of the best places is the Ramble.
An area which signs show dogs must be leashed. So when he asked the woman, Amy Cooper, no relation to Chris Cooper, to do that, she apparently refused.
I had pulled out my iPhone to record the incident because I try to do that routinely when there's somebody who's like just really intransigent about putting their dog on the leash. That made her irate.
I'm in the Ramble, and there is a man, African-American, he has a bicycle helmet. He's recording me and threatening me and my dog.
I wasn't going to participate in my own dehumanization and feed that. So I just kept recording.
I'm being threatened by a man into the Ramble. Please send the cops immediately.
Manhattan District Attorney candidate Eliza Orlins has been a public defender for more than a decade.
I know that the DA's office uses these hysterical 911 calls as categorical evidence of guilt. Without a recording of this interaction, it would be very difficult to refute her accusations.
It's not just about her. You know, she tapped into something that is pervasive in our society.
Having an experience, a viral experience of racial harassment during that time, particularly in the lens of the birding community, there was a group chat where we were like, well, let's think about what this means. Let's think about what it would mean to rise to the moment. Because we did not pick our moment. Like, right? Like, this is not at all anything that we planned very far ahead of time. It was in the group chat that I typed out Black Birders Week, ? And it seemed like a good pitch. It was put together in a matter of hours before it started, basically. It was like riding a bike as we were building it, and the bike was going downhill. But downhill in a good way. It was safe. Everyone had their helmets on. It was just really exciting. And I still think that there's part of me that still exists in that week, because it was like a timeless barrage of, I mean, mostly being on the internet. I had a broken ankle at the time, so I wasn't going out birding. It was just very, very engaging. And it had such an impact globally in a way that I don't think anyone really expected. I mean, we were going to have fun with it. The organizers of Black Birders, we knew that if we were just the audience, we were going to be just fine. Being an audience to so many people in a way that inspired them really, really means a lot.
Karina Newsom, who appeared in episode 30, What Does the Bible Say About Climate Change, got the week off to a great start.
The way Karina kicked off Sunday, Black in Nature, with that video was really great. And it really, I mean, it was something nice to wake up to. If people were just like, you know, bird Twitter was just being bird Twitter.
The impact was huge. Just how big?
I did ask some of my friends at the National Audubon Society, what was the social media footprint of Black Birders Week during those 6-7 days? And the number that I got was 600 million impressions. What does that mean? Right? Like, what does that mean? I don't know, but that 600 million sounds exciting. Like, it just sounds exciting.
Through Black Birders Week, Taiki and fellow Black Birders were determined to tell stories that happen all the time and get drowned out.
When the Black experience has been part of the national conversation, what we see is trauma so much. The Black experience goes beyond trauma. The Black experience encompasses joy, pride, resilience, strength, and style. Black Birders Week was all about that. It's nice that I can have a space, create a space, and build a space with people where we can be our authentic selves, knowing that we live in a country that is majority white, and whiteness has had a head start in defining so many things. So it's nice that my blackness and my birdness can create some joy. For Black Birders Week, we had a day where we would post a bird pic. I chose the European starling, a bird that is quite ubiquitous in the United States, North America, and Europe. The European starling's ancestors and my ancestors, we share the reality, the history of being brought across the Atlantic Ocean on ships against our will. And now we're just both here. So every time I look at a European starling, I always think about that, where I'm like, huh.
Taiki is quick to point out he is not a one-man show.
My support group, I think, starts with my girlfriend, who helps make sure that I'm eating between interviews and meetings. And she's always down to have something fun, do something fun. And, you know, she's actually started her eBird list this year. Gave me a very humble lesson in thinking about bird expertise from a new birder to me, relatively a veteran birder, because she identified a fox sparrow that I was sure was a song sparrow. I am so glad that she stayed on the path of, I don't think this is it. Looking at the field guide, looking at the pictures, putting things together. I'm really glad that she stayed on that. And, you know, that's one of the reasons I really adore her. She's really smart and headstrong. And she's a birder now. So, you know, even better. I also want to thank my mom. She's always checking in on me, even though she's in Philly and I'm in DC. We haven't seen each other in a while. We do Zoom cook-offs together now. And I take a lot of time doing that. If I'm not birding, if I'm not trying to organize stuff, I am in the kitchen. That patience and the connection that I feel with her in the kitchen is just how strong our relationship is. And I really love that about her.
While he was unable to physically go out birding last year as he recovered from an injury, for this year's Black Birding Week, he is going big.
You know, I want to do what I can to build the Black Birding community in DC. And so, I think I want to do a big week in DC. For those who aren't familiar with the big week or what does that mean, it just means that I'm going to bird for 7 days and try to see as many birds as I can all over DC. Hopefully with that, I can bring more attention to birding spots in DC that are in predominantly Black neighborhoods that I know and I've become familiar with, because the birding community will always list 7 Ward or 7-8 as the last places. And it's just like, why is that always the case? Hopefully I can bring a community of birders to enjoy this activity, to enjoy this community. Birding is a coalition builder. most of my experience with birding is all about building coalitions. It's all about organizing people.
Taiki models resilience and creative engagement with the world around him. He recognizes we can't always control the circumstances we face. We cannot change everything right away. Still, we're not helpless.
We are in a time of deep uncertainty and challenge and strife. None of this is easy. There is no manual. Did you get a manual in the mail on how to do this? Did you? It never came for you, did it? Okay. Well, I didn't get mine either. If anyone did get theirs, help us out. But in short of having those instructions on what to do next, it's important that we follow our values. It's important that we normalize how we demonstrate those values. It should never be a surprise to someone to hear an organization or an individual say, Black Lives Matter. It shouldn't be offensive, you know, to want to dismantle the status quo that has benefited and has had a head start for white supremacy and white privilege and patriarchal ideals that funnel into activities, that funnel into behaviors, that funnel into the things that we call normal today. So if you know those big name things are wrong, there are intentional and personalized things you can do.
To hear my entire conversation with Taiki James, visit Citizens Climate Radio over at SoundCloud.com. Be observant, like a practice birder. Be on the lookout for hashtag Black Birders Week as it appears in Twitter feeds, social media, and news reports. And you definitely want to follow Taiki James.
I try to be easy to find. My name's Taiki James on Twitter and Instagram. I also am the co-chair for the Black and Latinx Birders Scholarship Fund. You can check that out, amplifythefuture.org. That will be a growing project, a growing effort to get more Black and Brown people in STEM, get more Black and Brown birders supported by the birding community. You can also see Wildlife Observer Network if you are interested in some of my podcast or YouTube. I think that those are the best plugs, you know, for now.
Now it is time for the Art House. We begin on a New York City summer evening in 1852 with a 33-year-old man dressed up for a night out on the town. This unmarried man struggled to find his way in the world, having failed at a variety of professions: teacher, print shop operator, freelance writer. He also dabbled with poetry, but his poems, they sounded like much of the same uninspired writing of the day. But on that unseasonably hot night in New York City, this man had no idea how profoundly his life was about to change. His name was Walter. Walter Whitman. Yes, the same Walt Whitman, who later became one of the most important poets of the 19th, 20th, and 21st centuries. But before he could write his opus, Leaves of Grass, he first needed to visit New York's Metropolitan Opera Hall. That night, Whitman had an encounter with a woman. She moved him, not as a lover. No, what shook Whitman that night was not love, but art, in the form of a voice, the voice of Madame Marietta Albone, the great Italian opera singer on her triumphant American tour. Whitman had been to the opera many times before, but had heard nothing like this. Without flair, Albone sang clear and strong. And as Whitman listened, deep inside, his creative soul stirred.
Thank you.
This was pure art, not the trite, shallow stuff he had written as a young man. That night, Whitman had an apocalypse, the Greek word that means a revelation. As if a curtain had been pulled back and one sees what has been hidden from sight, this vision jars one awake. And that night, Whitman awoke. Quit his job, left the city, settled into a personal breakdown, then wrote feverishly. 3 years later, he self-published The Leaves of Grass, poetry so radical and deeply sensual, he didn't even dare include his name in the first edition. He just had a sketch of himself, open shirt, hat askew, jauntily looking at the reader. In that first edition of Leaves of Grass, he writes, "The smoke of my own breath echoes, ripples, and buzzed whispers. My respiration and inspiration, the beating of my heart, the passing of blood and air through my lungs, the sniff of green leaves and dry leaves, and of the shore and dark-colored sea rocks, and of hay in the barn, the sound of the belched words of my voice, words loosed to the eddies of the wind." Walt Whitman found his voice at last. He took seriously his role as a prophetic poet, and likely he would have kept his hands covered in ink until he faced a second apocalypse. In 1861, 6 years after he first published The Leaves of Grass, the American Civil War began. By its end, in 1865, over 600,000 soldiers died, the largest number of casualties of any American conflict. Whitman was a pacifist of a Quaker background and already middle-aged, but while visiting his wounded brother in an army hospital, surrounded by the groaning anguish of the war-mangled young men, seeing hundreds of amputees and boys dying from infected wounds, Whitman's eyes opened to the need around him. He wrote that he felt a profound conviction of necessity. For the remainder of the war years, Walt Whitman volunteered as a nurse, visiting soldiers in the many army hospitals, writing letters for them, bringing small gifts of food and books, sitting by their bedsides, holding them as they died in his arms, providing comfort however he could. He wrote, "These hospitals, so different from all others, these American young men, badly wounded, all sorts of wounds, operated on, pallid with diarrhea, languishing, dying with fever, pneumonia. Will they open a new world somehow to me, giving closer insights, showing our humanity, tried by terrible, fearfulest tests, probed deepest, bursting the petty bonds of art. To these, what are your dramas and poems?" Whitman saw this need, and he had to respond. And when we see need like we see today around coronavirus, the physical suffering, the economic hardship, in a way we have a choice. We could hunker down and get in our bunker and close up our hearts and protect ourselves. And self-protection is, of course, very important. But we could also open our hearts to show empathy and love and generosity. As I think about climate change, as we look at the impacts of climate change over time, we're going to see more and more extreme weather events, more and more people displaced who are brokenhearted, who are injured, losing home, losing work, and the need for us to look after each other will only deepen over time. Dr. Natasha DeJohnette, who has been on the show many times, is a public health expert, and she often says climate change poses the greatest risk to public health. It is also the greatest opportunity to improve public health. these difficult times that we're facing with coronavirus, with the economy, with climate change, it's not our first rodeo. We've been through hard times before, and we have the roadmap of what it takes to rebuild, to recover, to care for each other, to look after each other. And now it's time for our good news report. This good news story comes out of Portland, Oregon. Lane Schaefer is a 15-year-old high school student. He is one of several students seeking to change public transportation policy in the Portland area.
The Multnomah Youth Commission is a diverse coalition of youth ages 13 to 21, and over the past couple of years, we've been working to improve transit access to students and non-students in the Portland metro area. So in 2019, we were able to increase the amount of funding given to youth by over $200,000, which gave incredible amounts of funding to underserved schools in Portland, in the Portland area, and allocated passes so that students could access transit year-round. This was a really important development so that students would be able to access things like healthcare, education, sports, and all of those important things for development. Recently, we worked on a ballot measure, which would have provided transit access to all 85,000 students within our transit organization's reach. Unfortunately, this ballot measure did not pass, but we are currently working with state legislatures as well as city officials to work on developing a new plan for increasing transit access to youth. So one of the things that we've been working hardest on is making sure that people understand the effect that this will have on the climate. Currently, Portland is working on getting more electric buses, and this is an excellent plan. I love the idea of transitioning to electric buses, but if we don't have the ridership to back that up, there's not going to be a significant decrease in carbon emissions. One of the things that we've been driving hardest for is for youth transit access to be included within climate plans so that all students don't have to worry about having to pay when they get on the bus in order to get to school, in order to get to the student health centers that are provided at our schools, and all of these other amazing opportunities. We're currently making great strides with the Portland Mayor's Office in developing these plans, and we're working also with county officials to create a strategy in order to pass a bill that will allocate more funding to student transit passes.
In addition to working on this public transportation project, Lane Schaefer is also one of the hosts of All In My Head podcast. It's produced by a group of teens that are making a podcast for youth by youth. They counter stereotypes around mental health in the teen, Black, and Indigenous people of color and LGBTQ+ community. If you have good news you want to share on the show, email me, radio@citizensclimate.org. That's radio@citizensclimate.org. Thank you so much for joining me for episode 59 of Citizens Climate Radio. If you like what you hear and you want to support the work we do, visit citizensclimateeducation.org to learn how you can make a tax-deductible contribution. Citizens Climate Radio is written and produced by me, Peter Santoscano. Other technical support from Ricky Bradley and Brett Cease. Social media assistance from Ashley Hunt Mortarano, Flannery Winchester, and Steve Volk. Moral support from Madeline Pera. The music on today's show comes from epidemicsound.com. Now, I could use your help. When you have a chance, would you please share Citizens Climate Radio with your friends and colleagues? Maybe you even know a school teacher who might be able to use the podcast in the classroom. You can find our program wherever you listen to podcasts. You can also listen at northernspiritradio.org. Join the discussion we're having at our Facebook group page, facebook.com/group/citizensclimateradio. You can follow us on Twitter @CitizensCRadio. That's Citizens, the letter C, Radio, CitizensCRadio. And feel free to tweet at me directly @P2Sun, the letter P, the number 2, S-O-N. Visit citizensclimatelobby.org/blog, where you will find our show notes and links to our guest and resources. Citizens Climate Radio is a project of Citizens Climate Education.